This is The Reason Interview, where we go deep with the artists, entrepreneurs, policymakers, and visionaries who are making the world more libertarian, or at least a little more interesting. I'm Zach Weissmuller, filling in for Nick Gillespie. This week, our guest is Freddy Guevara, a Venezuelan dissident imprisoned by the Maduro regime in 2021. Guevara entered politics as a young activist opposing Hugo Chavez's 2007 attempt to rewrite the Constitution and shut down opposition media. This propelled him to become the youngest elected city council member in Venezuelan history, winning 81% of the vote before ascending to the country's National Assembly. Guevara now lives in exile and is a visiting fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School Ash Center for Democratic Governance and Innovation. We spoke about how the machinery of oppression actually works in authoritarian Venezuela, whether U.S.-led regime change is possible, and why Venezuela's collapse isn't just a result of Maduro's corrupt regime, but a predictable outcome of socialism in practice. This is a Reason Interview with Freddy Guevara. Freddy Guevara, thank you for coming on the Reason Interview.
Thank you very much for this invitation.
I wanted to have you on today because you're someone who intimately knows the political realities of Venezuela as a former member of the National Assembly and an enemy of the Maduro regime. Maduro obviously is in custody now, but you were arrested by the Maduro regime and jailed in July 2021, and you live streamed that arrest. I want to play a snippet of that to familiarize the audience with you, with the caveat that we've redubbed it into English with Hey Gen AI so our audio listeners can understand it. I hope that's not too strange for you. Let's roll that.
I decided to stay in my country despite, well, all these problems and the possibility that I could be detained again, knowing that, well, we are under a dictatorial regime, but here I am. I'm absolutely convinced that I did the right thing and that I will continue to do the right thing. To all of you, I want to say that I will keep moving forward. Why negotiate with a dictatorship? And it's not because I want to, it's because I believe it's the solution to get Venezuela out of the crisis.
That's so crazy.
Crazy times we live in for many reasons.
That's my accent in English. It's crazy, really.
So at the time, though, you were still trying to work within the system, even as you were being arrested. Why were you still somewhat hopeful back then?
I mean, I think in general, you know, to fight a dictatorship, you have to be optimistic, right?
Yeah.
There's no chance to... you cannot win if you believe you can win. So even in the darkest moments, you have to, you know, hold into something, into this hope. And I think the hope is grounded in the, you know, I think the main thing is that you're doing the right thing, right? And probably, you know, we're being kind of brainwashed with all of these movies and Hollywood and Disney movies that makes you believe that the good guys will win. That's not true. I learned that in a bad way, right? But I think, you know, when, at the same time, if I'm saying a little bit cynic about it, I think that having that conviction moves you forward. So at that moment, you know, I thought that, you know, all the institutional paths were closed, you know. And I thought that, you know, as many transitions, not only pressure, but making a negotiation was going to be able to help us to move from the tyranny to a democracy.
Yeah.
And well, you know, the response was putting me in jail.
And what were you trying to negotiate over? What exactly was the political issue at that moment?
In general, I mean, I can tell you about that moment, but in general, like every time that we have made a negotiation, because this was not the first time, right? The opposition has been, you know, caricaturized by many people. Like, oh, we're just extreme, you know, people, coup plotters that only want U.S. military intervention. This is 25 years of struggle.
And I mean, the Maduro regime accused you of treason and terrorism, like working with gangs and paramilitary groups. For our audience, I want to be clear. They released an indictment, but they never presented any concrete evidence against you. They released you under pressure from the U.S. Why do you think they really arrested you?
They went after me twice. The first one was 3 years in house arrest in the Chilean, in the house of the Chilean ambassador in Venezuela. Mm-hmm. That was because Maduro closed the parliament. I was vice president of the Congress of the parliament. In Venezuela, we just have one chamber. We don't have Senate and House. Mm-hmm. And I was vice president of the institution. Maduro closed the parliament. And I was one of the person who was leading the people in the streets to protest this. He went after mm-hmm. me that way, in that mm-hmm. time. This second time, we were with the interim government, you know, Juan Guaido, who was the president and was recognized by the Americans and many Western countries and democracies, not by Russia, China, etc. And in that moment, I was also supporting that strategy. And my role was supporting also like mobilizing people, but asking for a democratic solution, you know? So when a lot of people says to us, like, you know, you didn't try this, we tried everything. We tried everything, and that's why, for shocking for some people, most Venezuelans are happy and thankful that Maduro has been captured by the Americans.
And am I right to say that you were arrested at the time by a group called the Bolivarian National Intelligence Service?
Yeah.
Okay, for sure. Which is known as SEBIN in Spanish.
Yeah. It's like the political police.
Yeah, just describe. Could you just describe? Because I want people to really get a sense of like what it's like being a dissident in Venezuela. What is that? What is SEBIN? And how does it operate within Venezuela? What is its role?
I mean, SEBIN is one of the fourth, I would say, branches of repression of the regime. Mm-hmm. SEBIN is the police one, right? Mm-hmm. You have the GECIN, which is the military one that is more used against militaries that rebels against them. And you have also another police, which is more like for, let's say, citizens in general. The SEBIN is more for political opponents. Mm-hmm. And then you have a fourth one, which is, I would say, the craziest one, which is basically gangs. Right? Mm. They use them where they want to have deniability. They say like, you know, these people were shot, but it's just insecurity. This is a Latin American country. So yeah, we have insecurity. Yeah. So this one is particularly, is mostly used for political targets. Like in my case there, like me, I was member of the Congress and member of the opposition. So these people are civilians. They are not military. I would have to say it's very interesting because you have like three different types of people there. One that are ideological evil people, for sure. You have other ones that are kind of like, you know, the banality of evil, like what Hannah said. Like they are just like, well, yeah, this is just my orders. And I'm doing this. This is my job. I'm sorry for you, but this is my job. And you have other type of people that for me was very surprising. It was kind of a reflection on how even in darkness you can find some light. People that were doing wrong, don't get me wrong, they were doing wrong, but they knew it and they were trying to help from within somehow, giving you some food or a paper or something, right? Mm. So I'm describing this because all of these regimes are made of people and they use this type of overlapping structures to persecute them. And yeah, and that prison is the biggest one and the most horrible one in Venezuela.
It's very interesting and illuminating to hear you describe the mechanics of how that sort of oppression works. Because as you mentioned, since Maduro's detainment, the people of Venezuela are happy. They're celebrating. Yeah. There's recent polling conducted by The Economist, which I'm pulling up here, showing that over 50% strongly agree or somewhat agree with the statement, I support the U.S. capture of Maduro. A second question I put here is, if a presidential election were held tomorrow, which candidate would you vote for? And Maria Corina Machado is the runaway favorite there. We'll get to her later. But what does this say to you about the way, like, how does that happen if so much of the population, if we're to trust this polling, is happy that Maduro has fallen? How do they maintain power for so long? What is the mechanics of that?
I mean, for people who don't believe, who hasn't lived in an authoritarian regime, mm-hmm. it's very interesting this question. sorry, for people that live in authoritarian regimes, it's very interesting this question, because it means that you have so entrenched in yourself the idea that power comes from consent from the people, mm-hmm. that for you that doesn't make sense, right? It's like, how, why, if a population wants something different is happening. But the reality is that most areas in the world, people are governed by people who don't care about what they think, right? So you can, depending in each the country, right? Sorry that I'm being also a little bit theoretical, but also that's part of my job in Harvard now. So, and I'm talking about global things, but also the Venezuelan thing. But I think it makes sense to see the whole picture, because many autocrats don't just rely on repression, right? You have other tools of power. And Chavez, who was an autocrat too, I wouldn't say he was the same type of autocrat as Maduro, he used other leverage, including popular support, because Chavez also had popular support. But he had money from oil, you know, he also had geopolitical power, he used the media, he also everything. Maduro is different, because Maduro lost the economy, lost the oil, lost international support, lost the media, lost all the powers. So he only relied on repression. So when you get in this type of regimes that are, you know, just relying on that, basically Maduro holds, not because all the military and all the police supports him. He holds on, or he was able to hold on during that time, because he had a very small repressive apparatus that didn't have to repress all the population. They just needed to repress the right people. So they use a mix of corruption to buy loyalty, highly ideology, and this is very important, international military support from Cuba, China, Iran, and Russia. Many people, we would say this for years, and many people were like, oh, you're just exaggerating. You're just saying this because you want the Americans to do the job for you. And what happened after Maduro was captured? The Cuban dictatorship released a public statement saying that 32 Cuban military were killed. So it's not a lie. It was confirmed by them, right? The inner circle of Maduro were not Venezuelans, because they can't trust them. It was the Cubans.
Yeah, okay. So that brings us to the capture of Maduro and the role that the U.S. is playing in all this. He's now in U.S. custody. First, what was your initial reaction to the American operation to capture him when you happiness. First heard about this?
Happiness, shock and happiness and tears of joy. You know, it's like I saw this butcher being captured. That's like heaven, you know?
There are some dissenters in America, including many libertarians who will be listening to this show, that worry that now we're going to get pulled back into nation building, which is something Trump explicitly ran against. What would you say to them, or how would you speak to those concerns?
I mean, I would say there's two types of concerns. I have to say that I believe, and I love this about the United States, and think you have all the right to criticize your government and scrutinize and do accountability. That's what we want for Venezuela, too. We want to be able to do that without being in jail, right? Mm-hmm. So for me as a Venezuelan, the discussion is not about, you know, oh, Americans are complaining about this. That's your right. But many Venezuelans were concerned about some type of American saying, no, that's not good for Venezuelans. We know more what Venezuelans want from them, you know? So this is a thing that in one thing I think needs to be addressed. And I think this poll that you said, that you show, it's like, okay, you know, ask Venezuelans what they want. Venezuelans are happy. This is not about U.S. imperialism or oil or Trump. This is about basic rights and fear. However, with the approach of the nation building, I would have to say this. And of course, this gets into an ideological discussion too, but I believe that we live in an interconnected world. Mm-hmm. So United States, and I think non-country, but United States, you don't have the luxury to have someone at 3 hours on a plane that becomes the center of a hub for in Latin America, the hub for China, Russia, Iran, terrorism, cartels. You can be, you know, all that you want, you know, looking it in your own self, but, you know, it will reach you it reach, because many of the people that came here, and I know that also people would say like, no, that's a lie, that was exaggerations for justifying, like, no, there were Venezuelan gangs in United States. Some of them were sent by Maduro. Some of them were just part of the migration crisis. Migration also as a crisis in general. I love Venezuelans, and I think that, you know, we contribute to the American economy, but I also understand, like, the massive migration, like, it created in shock, let's say, create shocks in societies. So even just in that area, if you don't think, just if you don't think about the geopolitical implications, security, drugs, and all that, if you think just about, like, the migration issues, it will affect you, because it's not a reality that you can have a country isolated from the rest of the world.
So this is the justification that the Trump administration has laid out as well. They're hearkening back to the Monroe Doctrine, which he's rebranded the Donroe Doctrine, which is, you know, if it's in our hemisphere, the U.S. has an interest in stability in countries, and Venezuela is a failed state. And as such, yeah, we saw a lot of celebrations from Venezuelans abroad when it happened for understandable reasons. The question now really is, and always with intervention, is there's the ideal and there's the reality. The ideal is always, you know, when these interventions are first embarked upon, is, okay, well, we're going to transition this authoritarian regime to a democracy. But that tone shifted pretty quickly when it became clear that Maduro's vice president was Delcy Rodriguez, is the one who would assume leadership, and that the Trump administration would be working with her. What is your reaction to the ascent of Delcy Rodriguez to the head of state?
Yeah, I mean, of course, we don't want that, right? For sure. However, at the same time, we understand that, you know, transitions are a complicated thing. And I am not an interpreter or analyst of the Trump administration. However, what I can assume is that they chose a path to try to create, let's say, a controlled implosion of the regime. And not, let's say, it's more like a reform and not a revolution. I think that's what they're baiting for. And I think they analyzed and got to the conclusion that it was safer and more stable to do it with people that control the actual factual power within the rural country, that to the opposition now, and that they want to build or help us build the path that will end in an election. And from here to there, then we will have the conditions for the people who get selected, that I have any doubts that it will be from the opposition, will have the support of the, you know, the already purged institutions that are not necessarily involved with cartels, terrorism, or the dictatorship, right? However, at the same time, I think that, you know, there's also a discussion about economy. And it's very interesting also hearing some Americans saying, oh, this is just about oil. This American just wants your oil. And Venezuelans always say, like, what do you think the Chinese, the Russians, and the Iranians wanted? It's like, they like us because they like our culture and our music and our food. No, they also wanted oil. So it's like, you know, what we prefer a thousand times to deal with the Americans than to deal with the Chinese. Is the ideal situation? No, I believe in self-determination. We all want to have a country in which we elect all the authorities, and authorities elected by Venezuelans run the country. But in this reality, when we have been intervened for many years, also by foreign bad actors, we need the support of the Americans. And I will say, I would like that it will not be just the Americans. You know, if the rest of the world stop being so hypocritical, they should be also sending help and helping to dismantle what has been built in Venezuela in their eyes, you know, in front of their eyes.
What's the hypocrisy that you see from the rest of the world?
Oof, too much. But I will have to say the first one is the discussion about the international order, right? So it's a discussion about, like, no, the international order, like, if it works well for Belarusians, Ukrainians, Palestinians, Israelis, Venezuelans, Myanmar people, like, you know, all the world, all the oppressed people has been killed, slaughtered, and the international order doesn't work. So as a Venezuelan was saying the other day, if the international order couldn't protect me or my friends couldn't protect me from being tortured or persecuted, but it can protect Maduro from not being in jail, then the international order is not just not working. It's working against the people. And And I think this discussion is a big hypocrisy thing because nobody cares. It's also the same thing of oil. Nobody cared that oil of Venezuela was being taken for free by Cuba and with the Chinese. Nobody cared about that. Oh, but now people want Venezuelans to control their oil. Oh, now. Now because you have a vision of the world in which you hate the United States or you don't like Trump or you are worried about your interests. Because there's a lot of ideological Manichaeism here today. So if like, oh, if this people is from the right, then I don't like him. Or if these people from the left, then I don't like him. And it's like, no, you cannot pick and choose who's your autocrat depending on his policies and economy or social issues. You know, an oppressor is an oppressor, even if it's from the right or from the left or from the right.
Yeah. So on the topic of oil, Trump has been remarkably explicit about his desire to control Venezuela's oil. You know, in the past, there's always been accusations that U.S. foreign policy was driven by this control of resources, but it was never kind of openly admitted. That's sort of the characteristic of Trump, is that he just says the unsaid. And his energy secretary has been very clear that part of the deal is that you know, Venezuela can still sell its oil to places like China, but it's going to be, they're going to have to kind of check in with the U.S. first. And the U.S. is going to control some of the revenue going back to the government with strings attached. How do you feel as a Venezuelan? Because it's just a fact that that is a severe impingement on your, you know, national sovereignty. Yeah. I also understand that you were experiencing, you know, a totalitarian regime. So, like, what is your feeling about that situation where, yeah, now you're kind of under the whims of the Trump administration?
I want to say, of course, I would like this to be different, but I have to say something very clear.
Okay.
National sovereignty without human rights is just an excuse to protect an elite to oppress people. You know, so you're just assuming that because there's this, you know, construct about a limit that we agree that this is the limit of my country, then from within, why national sovereignty is more important than human rights? Why crossing a border is more important than people being able to live and not being tortured? In the world that I want to live, everything matters, right? And of course, I don't want a world in which anyone can enter another country and create mess. But I want to live in a world in which there's no dictator who can say the national sovereignty, you know, matters. And so I can do whatever I want with the population that lives that I have here hostage. Mm-hmm. So saying this, we truly believe that, of course, what we want is at the end of this process is that we have, as I said, you know, Venezuelan authorities selected by Venezuelans who can run our industry, our economy and everything. And to be very clear, we have the United States as the main partners. This is my vision, my ideology. But if Venezuelans choose another leader, another party, another person who believes different, that's okay, you know, but that's democracy. If someone wants to have a different partner, that's okay. I believe that the United States should be our main ally in many ways. And it is, so at the same time, I will say that I believe and we believe that economic interests of the United States can be aligned with the democratic rights of Venezuelans. Because this process, not only the economic interests, but I'm going to talk about it, but it's like, it's very entrenched with one another. Why? First, for example, oil. If Americans actually help us to rebuild the industry and make it right, it will require rule of law, it will require control on corruption, and it will require to stop being sending it for free from Cuba, China, Russia, and Iran. And what's the relationship of that with democracy? Well, as I said, when we were talking about the political of the repression apparatus, many of the repression is fueled by the oil, but also is fueled by the international alliance. So I think, like, if we cut those ties indirectly, you will be benefiting the, you know, the democracy in Venezuela. So this is just an example. I don't want to make it too long, but I believe, and of course, this is the trick and this is the art that we have to make. How do we align American interests with Venezuelan interests?
Yeah, so you're laying out a transition period and a sort of compromise with the it's not the ideal, but there is no ideal right now. It does involve, you mentioned it would need, in order for kind of a functioning oil market, for instance, in Venezuela, you would need to have a functioning rule of law. And Exxon's CEO in, Trump held this summit of all the big oil companies, and the Exxon CEO at that summit basically said, we can't invest in Venezuela. I know you want us to, but it's uninvestable because it has no rule of law. And so that implies, and Marco Rubio has said this as well, that's part of what the U.S. wants to do, is help Venezuela establish that. But like, given America's recent track record with building that up in countries, we obviously think back to the last decade with the Middle East, how confident or worried are you that that's even possible under a very capricious U.S. regime?
I think that it's possible. I think it's in the benefits of now of the United States that we have that. I think the people in Venezuela that are now holding power, the ones that are running the Maduro's leftovers, I think they don't want it. We cannot be fooled. We have to understand and assume that their plan, I know them. I deal with them many times. And I think they are smarter than Trump. And they're going to try to, and one had to say, they are advised for a very, very tiny regime who has outsmarted the United States for decades, which is the Cuban regime. So they believe that can happen. So they're going to try to do it. And we need all the, we need to keep having the pressure and the gun in the table in order to make them do it, because they will never do it if they don't have the right pressure. Of course, incentives too. So I believe that we're gonna move in that path. It's not gonna be easy, and probably we'll have to do some type of transitional spaces and things like this. But the final outcome, I'm very optimistic that we're gonna be able to do it.
You outlined the Trump administration's logic pretty well earlier when talking about Delcy Rodriguez, the former vice president who's now running the Venezuelan government. And you said that their calculation is that if an outsider were coming in, that they might not have control of the levers of power, the police, the military, and so forth, and there would be the risk of something like a civil war, which the U.S. does not want to be getting pulled into. And so the idea here is kind of Delcy Rodriguez is someone who Trump feels like he can work with for the moment. As someone who's been involved in the government in Venezuela, how sound is that logic? Do you think that Rodriguez is somebody who can be worked with in the short term, or is this a mistake?
I hope I am wrong, but I don't trust, the Rodriguez at all. I am not as worried, because I think that Trump is not stupid and Marco Rubio is not stupid. Mm-hmm. I think they both are clever people, in the way that you might agree or not with their policies, but I think they are clever. They are not easy to be mischief. And I think that the Rodriguez siblings can make a... when I talk about the Rodriguez siblings, it's because Delcy is the head, but her brother is the second one, and they work together. They're the same thing. This is a tyranny of law. And I think they're going to try to smart them, but if the Trump administration and Rubio finds out and they keep acting as they've been acting, I think it's going to be worse for them. For them, I mean the Rodriguez siblings. Yeah. So I don't trust them at all. But at the same time, I have to say, because of my work, I study with a lot of transitions, autocracies, and things like that. Many transitions in the world from autocracies to democracies have happened with people from the old regime that, have surprises. So I really hope, I don't say this is not a personal thing. If I like them or not, it's a personal level. If they can comply with what the Trump administration is doing, and at the same time, building a path for a democratic transition, why I will say no.
I saw a lot of Venezuelans reacting very negatively online to one particular New York Times story about Rodriguez, where there was this description of Rodriguez as the moderate vice president. And this is particularly striking to someone like me who's covered Argentine politics, for instance, where the constant drumbeat is to describe their president, Javier Milei, as a far right libertarian. And there is a sort of asymmetry there that's pretty striking. What do you make of like the US media's understanding of Latin American politics and how the situation is generally described?
I mean, I'm saying this because what I'm going to say, I also say it to them. I've been speaking with people from the New York Times. I've been very clear with them that my opinion, that our opinion, is that they're weaponizing the Venezuelan situation just to confront Trump. That's it. Right? And at the same time, you can have other interests. That's different, right? I don't think there's a conspiracy in the New York Times and in some media saying like, we have to, you know, I think it's just like an initial bias that if Trump says A, I will say B. If Trump's, you know, this is kind of a thing.
Sure.
But also there's a thing that we cannot underestimate, the power of lobby. Delcy Rodriguez has been promoted from a group of, business people from a long time ago. And they have reached also, you know, people in the United States. I am not saying the New York Times is bi. I don't have any proof to say this. But I have to say is that this is a play that someone was building it from before. And I think that at least it's bad journalism to qualify Delcy as a moderate, because Delcy's line of command, the people that put me in jail was under her command. You know,
right.
So it's like, how do people who has the political police under her command and political prisoners is a moderate?
Yeah. She was sort of in charge of the secret police, or not the secret police,
the vice presidency, in the I don't know how to call it, the hierarchy in the Venezuelan state, the vice presidency. Below it, it's the Sabine.
Yeah. Okay.
So all political prisoners there are her political prisoners.
Yeah. So moderate head of the politicized police force is not really a coherent descriptor. Okay. Yeah. So many Venezuelans had hoped that Maria Corina Machado, the opposition leader recently awarded a Nobel Prize, would be the one to replace Maduro. But Trump has said she does not have the support or respect within the country. She's a very nice woman, but she doesn't have the respect. How accurate is that from your point of view?
Again, I cannot interpret what President Trump said, but what I think he was referring was to the, the necessary respect within the people who are holding now the institutions, right?
Right.
That was their path. That's what I believe he was saying, because he knows that Maria Corina is the most supported leader in Venezuela now, right?
Yeah.
And they know their intelligence. Probably they were talking more about like these entrenched groups that they needed their support in order to move.
So you think that that's plausible then, that he's right, that to kind of get Machado in there right away, there would have been some big risks to that?
I mean, if that was the path, they decided we want to work. Basically, I mean, and if you think about it, it kind of makes sense in their logic, in the way that, you know, they were saying to Maduro, I want to deal with you. You know, let's have a negotiation. Go out and we do it, you know, in the right way. Maduro dance, say no, he's taken. Now they're going with the next layer. So I think they're trying to do this. And of course, I think if you ask these people, if you ask the Rodriguez, if you ask the top criminals that are there, if they want to be run by Maria Corina, they're going to say no, right? So I think in that sense, it makes sense. It makes sense in that plan. So yeah, that's my analysis, what they're thinking. I'm not there, but that's what I think they were thinking.
Yeah, and Trump is meeting with Machado tomorrow. As of this recording, we're recording this on January 14th, Wednesday, January 14th. They're meeting on Thursday. And just for listeners who may not have kept up with this. Machado was the leader of the opposition party who was challenging Maduro in the last presidential election. She got disqualified for quite dubious reasons and then threw her support behind another candidate who, by independent election observations, actually won the election, and Maduro stole that last election. So that's, and then she went on to win the Nobel Prize last year. What do you hope comes of that meeting between Machado and Trump?
I think the first thing that I would like to know is like information about what is the deal and the conditions that, you know, the Delcy and Jorge Rodriguez regime are going to be accountable for. That, because that's what we need to know. That's important, right? The second thing is, I think, a commitment with keeping up the pressure or increasing the pressure if they don't comply, right? And I think the most important one is about the freedom of all political prisoners. I think that's the most important thing. And recovering the capacity to dissent in Venezuela. Because there's, you cannot talk about the democratic transition if you cannot dissent freely in Venezuela, right? So we have to recover that right, because many of the agency of the democratic forces, you know, has been diminished, not because they don't have support or we don't have support. María Corina has most of, in the same poll that you referred, it's clear the support of the people. But you cannot exercise that leverage because you've been ousted of the country. And if you're inside, you're in prison or you have to be in captivity. Right. So I think that's a very important topic that needs to be addressed. And hope, I mean, Marco Rubio, Secretary Rubio, said it when he explained the three phases. And I think this has to be, you know, the shortest and fastest transition as possible.
Yeah, I have that clip of Rubio explaining the three phases. Let me play that so that we're all kind of on the same page.
As we move forward, we'll describe our process, which is a threefold process in Venezuela. I've described it to them now. Step one is the stabilization of the country. We don't want it descending into chaos. Part of that stabilization, and the reason why we understand and believe that we have the strongest leverage possible, is our quarantine. As you've seen today, two more ships were seized. We are in the midst right now, and in fact about to execute on a deal to take all the oil. They have oil that is stuck in Venezuela. They can't move it because of our quarantine and because it's sanctioned. We are going to take between 30 and 50 million barrels of oil. We're going to sell it in the marketplace at market rates, not at the discounts Venezuela was getting. That money will then be handled in such a way that we will control how it is dispersed in a way that benefits the Venezuelan people, not corruption, not the regime. So we have a lot of leverage to move on the stabilization front. The second phase will be a phase that we call recovery, and that is ensuring that American, Western, and other companies have access to the Venezuelan market in a way that's fair. Also, at the same time, begin to create the process of reconciliation nationally within Venezuela so that the opposition forces can be amnestied and released and from prisons or brought back to the country and begin to rebuild civil society. And then the third phase, of course, will be one of transition. Some of this will overlap. I've described this to them in great detail. We'll have more detail in the days to follow. But we feel like we're moving forward here in a very positive way.
Okay, so stabilization, taking and selling the oil at market rates, recovery, which is what you were just talking about, which is releasing the political prisoners. As of this recording, I believe about 70 or so of the more than 800 known political prisoners have been released. And then transition to democracy and sovereignty. The concern that lingers in my mind, just seeing how things have gone in the past and knowing how Trump operates, is that there could be getting stuck on step one and two, kind of, where if the U.S. takes control of the oil and Trump feels like someone like Rodriguez is working with him and, you know, generating revenue, that they never move beyond that step. Is that a concern that lingers in your mind as well, or am I being overly pessimistic here?
What I understand, I mean, you mean like if they take advantage of this, that can benefit them?
I just mean that Trump is a very transactional president. Mm-hmm. He is not, has never demonstrated himself to be very idealistic or worried about whether a leader is democratic or autocratic, as long as they can work with him. And if someone like Delcy Rodriguez is autocratic, but she works with him in a way more so than someone like Maduro did, then you're going to kind of be stuck in that phase.
I think President Trump said in the meeting with the old companies, a journalist asked him like what was more important, stability or democracy? Mm-hmm. And he said it's the same. So I think that's important because that reveals at least something that is in his mind. And I will agree that, in the short term, DLC can, help you with this or this, but they're not a reliable partner. They will do whatever they want as soon as they, there is an internal crisis and Trump has to, or there's an issue, China invades Taiwan and then Trump has to move the chips for there, they're going to turn his back on America.
Yeah.
2 seconds. They're just waiting to betray. So I think all of them knows it. And I think, this allegory or metaphor about the story of the toad and the scorpion, do you know that?
Yeah. The scorpion, the frog. Yeah.
That's going to happen. It's their nature. The nature of the people from the regime in Venezuela. They're going to prove us. I hope not. I think they're going to prove us.
They're going to sting because they're scorpion. Yeah. That's what scorpions do. Okay. I did want to ask you before you go also about this issue of the indictment against Maduro, which has changed over time. This was the original indictment, which accused him of being a leader of the Cartel de los Soles. And the objective was to flood the United States with cocaine. The superseding indictment, which came out after he was detained, Maduro participates in, perpetuates, and protects a culture of corruption in which powerful Venezuelan elites enrich themselves through drug trafficking and the protection of their partner drug traffickers. And then it goes on to describe this Cartel de los Soles as a patronage system, a reference to it translates to Cartel of the Suns, and it's a reference to the sun insignia affixed to the uniforms of high-ranking Venezuelan military officials. Attention's been paid to this because there is a difference here between whether Maduro is being accused of running an actual organized cartel or whether we're describing him overseeing this kind of decentralized, corrupt patronage network. What is your understanding of how that all works? The drugs make their way from Venezuela to the U.S.?
I quite frankly can't understand why that change was so important for many people.
Uh-huh.
Because the outcome is the same. The outcome is a state, not a part of, not a cartel, a state used as a cartel and as a terrorist supported platform. So I don't know. I think people think of cartels like, okay, Maduro has his job from 9 to 5, and then at 5, I have to go to my cartel meeting, and then he put his cartel hat and then has a meeting with the cartel people. It doesn't work like that, right? Mm-hmm. But it's worse. The patronage system, because it's a state used as that. And this is something that was not just said by the Trump administration. The Biden administration increased the reward. Before the Biden administration, the Trump administration said it. And before Trump, Obama also was, releasing this executive order of Venezuela as a threat. And before Obama, you had the investigation from Canada and CNN saying that Venezuelans' passports were used to support terrorists to enter the United States. So if he was a cartel or a patronage system, the outcome is the same. Drugs, passports, guns, and support for enemies of the United States were there. And at the same time, they were killing and torturing Venezuelans. So,
I think that the big difference in terms of U.S. policy is that if there's a very specific hierarchical structured group, then the strategy, it's almost like a counterterrorism strategy, or, Trump has declared this war on the cartels. Whereas if it's this really entrenched, like decentralized system, that seems a little bit more complicated to dismantle. So but I'm picking up from you that it's more like the latter. So it's like the solution here is to create a more stable Venezuelan institutions, right?
Yeah, because it's the same. Yeah. You have like, I cannot say that all of the people in the state are like, I have to tell you this story. This is very like, you know, it tells a lot. We were talking with a military guy that is within the regime. We were trying to make connections and things like this, right? And so the person asked him like, okay, but so your boss here, he's a drug lord or not? No, he's not a drug lord. And then, you know, this person checks the file and says like, yeah, but I mean, a lot of drugs are passing from this and they're being stored here. And it's like, yeah, that's true. So it's like, I don't get it. Why you say he's not a drug lord, but he's using the facilities from the army in that position to move and storage drugs. And he says like, well, but we also do it with like, you know, TVs or black market things. And that doesn't make us a refrigerator company. So, you know, it's like the mindset that they have, that it's like, yeah, no, we're just using our facilities to pass drugs, to pass TV, to pass refrigerators, to pass food, to you know, to traffic oil, but it doesn't, that doesn't convert us in a drug dealer or, as I said, as a refrigerator company or a TV company. So this is a mindset that it's been entrenched in the system. So at the end, I think that the Maduro capture was a necessity for Venezuelans, of course, but I think also for America and for the rest of the continent, for the rest of the continent too, because the crisis in Colombia, the crisis in Peru, the crisis in Chile, the crisis in Brazil, the crisis in Argentina are also fueled by the Maduro regime. So I think this is a good thing to that it happened. And I think that to dismantle this operation, we will need to work on this path and achieve a democratic transition in Venezuela.
Yeah, I will have to make the basic libertarian point also on the U.S. side that long-term, if to undermine drug cartels, a strategy of legalization to take away their market power is something that I think is going to have to happen, because there will always be a whenever there's that kind of demand, there's going to be some willing suppliers. I don't think we're ready for that conversation really in America yet. And I don't want to get too sidetracked here, because I did want to ask you before we wrap a bigger picture question about what happened to Venezuela, because there are actually many defenders of Hugo Chavez, Maduro's predecessor to this day on the American left. And they say basically that his socialism worked in its day. It was U.S. imperialism, economic sanctions, and the authoritarian corruption of Maduro specifically, not socialism, that caused Venezuela's downfall. What do you make of that analysis?
BS. You know, you have to live it. It's not a theory. We live it. We saw all what these policies make, and we know, you know, what's the outcome. So, I mean, I don't want, I work at Harvard, right? So I know a lot of people who are liberal or very, very from the left, a lot from the left. And I understand this is not something that just happens to Americans, but a lot of Americans, you know, act like this. It's easy to see the world with your own lenses and then analyzing everything in terms of race, in terms of social class, in terms of, you know, it's not necessarily the same. So a lot of people were seeing Venezuela as, this is this, you know, guy that came from the poor people who rise to power to defend from the elites. The elites were aligned with the United States and all of this crap that is not true. Mm-hmm. And because it's a different history, it's the thing with race in Venezuela is different. The class in Venezuela is different. Like, of course, there are many things that can be related to many things. But what I'm saying is, like, you cannot evaluate. That's colonialism. That's imperialism. Trying to understand other people's history through your own lenses, right? Mm. It's the same type of racism or colonialist approach that thinks that, no, Venezuela will be like Iraq. You don't understand nothing if you think that Venezuela will be Iraq. It's like two different societies, countries, periods, anything. But I would just have to say, like, I mean, I think every society has the right to decide their future, their policies, their governments. But I think also it would be good if you try to learn from others' experiences. So if you have an experiment that every time that has been tried, it ends in hunger, repression, you know, maybe it's time to think that there's something wrong with those premises.
Yeah.
As a professor of mine at university in Caracas said, like, you know, the people were not jumping from free Germany to the communist Germany, and not the boats are not going from Miami to Cuba.
Yeah.
So there's a reason for that. So of course, I know that capitalism, United States, all of this, we have a lot of issues. I believe that, you know, we can have a lot of discussions about this. And I believe that it would be great why this system has to be the only one that exists. And we can imagine for sure. But please don't tell me that the alternative is to looking at Marx, to looking at Hugo Chavez, or to looking at all of these failures that have created mass hunger, destruction, and oppression.
Yeah. Well, it's because real socialism has never been tried, I'm told.
Yeah. That's okay. Yeah.
So what, last thing, because I know you have, you're a busy man, you have lots more to attend to today. What are your short and medium term hopes for Venezuela over these next few weeks and months?
I have very clear, like, what's point A and what's the final thing. The starting point has to be the freedom of all political prisoners and the end of repression. And with this, I mean that, you know, you free 1,000, but then you put 2,000 people in jail. That doesn't work, right? We want to have the conditions, and that the regime knows that they can't persecute more people for dissenting, and if they do, they will pay a price. The end of this line is free and fair elections, right? Mm-hmm. What happens in between, it's very, you know, it can change, it can be discussed. How is it happening? If it's a presidential election first, or we have general elections, we have parliamentary first, if we're going to do transitional justice, or if we're going to have an international tribunal, or if we do all of those discussions, you know, very open. History has shown us that, you know, transitions are messy, are like this. And then we have to be open to understand that things are not going to work out as we want. Things are not going to work for the other sides as anyone. No Trump, none of us will get what we want at the end. But I think that we can achieve some basis that will allow to have a viable, you know, future and path for everyone. And that includes the people that put me in jail, because I cannot wipe them all. That exists. They are there. They have 20% of people who support them. That's a lot, right? If we have a multi-partisan, they will have 20% of the parliament, right? So what are we going to do? We're going to kill them all or expel them from the country? No, we can't. That's not viable either, right? I think they're stupid. I don't understand why they believe that, but that's their right. So in all of this process, we need to create a negotiation. How is it? Who are there? We're going to think how it happened. But that negotiation will only work if we still have the international pressure. If they believe that they can do whatever they want and there will be no consequences, we're done. And we're going to go back to Maduro's time.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I obviously hope for the best for the people of Venezuela, and that you can achieve that sort of reconciliation instead of the endless cycle of revenge. Freddy Guevara, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much.